Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Nathan Sterner, in today for Dan Rodericks. Thank you for joining us for the second hour of Midday, or staying tuned from the first, if that's the case. We're wrapping up Midday's Candidates Week this hour with Douglas Scansler, one of three Democrats seeking his party's nomination in the primary election just 4 days away, Tuesday of next week, the 24th of June. The outgoing Attorney General will later be joined by his running mate, Delegate Jolene Ivey of Maryland's 47th District, representing Prince George's County. Prior to serving 8 years as Maryland's top legal official, Doug Gansler was a federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C., later became state's attorney for Montgomery County. He's in studio now to tell us about his career in the law and in politics, and to give us his vision for the future of Maryland should he be elected to the state's highest office, and of course, to answer your questions. Midday at WYPR.org is where you can send emails, and we can take your calls at 410-662-8780. Attorney General Doug Gansler, welcome to Midday. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
We have asked every candidate who's been joining us this week the same question to start off the hour. As you have campaigned across Maryland, attending forums and meet and greets and what have you heard from the voters? What are Marylanders telling you their issues are and what they want you to do?
Well, I think clearly the biggest issue I hear about is the taxes and the jobs issue here in Maryland, that the taxes are too high. You know, the Brown and O'Malley administration has raised over 40 straight taxes and another 30-some-odd fees, and it's really squeezing the middle class, and people are just want relief from that. And so, of course, we put out a middle-class tax cut recently to try and alleviate some of that burden, but also the jobs. You know, the jobs are leaving. We've lost over 8,000 small businesses in the last 8 years, and right here in Baltimore, the city we love, you know, 46% of the adults don't have work. And so it's getting worse, and people want a change. And I think that's what we're hearing out there most.
Jobs policy first. What is your plan to generate more jobs in Maryland?
Well, first you have to recognize there's a problem, and these guys don't seem to recognize that. You know, last week there was another report saying that our economy was 49th in the country, right ahead of Alaska. We're 49th in personal income growth. You know, we only have four Fortune 500 companies left. McCormick is now announcing they're going to leave. So, you know, it's really unsustainable as a state, because as a Democrat, we have to make sure that we increase our tax base, that people are working, we're bringing more money in, so we can do things like address the minority achievement gap we have in Baltimore City and some of the other issues that we do have. So we've been talking about bringing in manufacturing. We're now 46th in the country in manufacturing, so bringing that back to Baltimore and to the state of Maryland, but also focusing on a couple of the industries where we're particularly strong, life sciences and cybersecurity as examples. We're the only state in the country that has NIH. We're the only state in the country that has Johns Hopkins, the number one hospital in the country last 21 out of 22 years, along with the University of Maryland system. We have the Cyber Command Center. We have the NSA. And we have the smartest people in the country in terms of advanced degrees. So we need to really focus on those two industries and grow that. And those are boundless in terms of growth potential. And then leverage the Port of Baltimore, one of the two deep sea ports on the East Coast, as well as BWI Airport. So there's a lot to be done, but we first have to recognize there's a problem and bring somebody in whose top agenda item is bringing jobs back to Maryland.
You started off that list of items with bringing back manufacturing. How do you bring back manufacturing? That's a difficult one to do.
Well, Attorney General Cuomo, now Governor Cuomo in New York, has come out with a policy that's actually working, and manufacturing concerns are going back to New York because he's giving tax relief to the manufacturer. So you can imagine, say, in Baltimore City, a city that has 47,000 vacant homes, that you could take a city block and say to a Kevin Plank at Under Armour or some of the other companies around the country, look, you tell us what it'll take for you to come here and manufacture, make your sneakers here in Maryland. We're not competing with India or China anymore. It's a flat world in that regard. We're competing with neighboring states. So if they're willing to come in here, you give them tax incentives, and then people will be able to make their sneakers here. There's a number of other issues as well in terms of jobs. Two of them I think are pretty relevant and pretty important. One is a plan that we have where, you know, you have to stay in your school till you're 18. What we want to do is when you're 16, to have every child in Maryland, if they want to continue the traditional track, they can. But others, if they just choose to, say, be an electrician, they can, at 16 years old, they can continue to do math and English. In the afternoons, they can do vocational and career apprenticeships. So then when we're 18, they now have a diploma from school and a certification to begin work on Monday.
In that hypothetical that you just mentioned, we can clear out a city block and put up a manufacturing center. You said that you would say to the company, what would it take? Where would you draw the line? What would you offer them? Where would you stop making offers to pool companies?
Well, right now, look, I mentioned Baltimore City, but you can also go to Western Maryland, which is just bleeding. I mean, it's sad. These cities and towns are dying on the vine because they used to be reliant on manufacturing, and all the companies have gone over to Pennsylvania or West Virginia. And you basically can say, look, you can come here tax-free 5 years, whatever it is, because right now we're getting nothing from the footprint of these manufacturing companies that have left. And you can give them a five-year tax break or whatever you might want to do, as long as they're employing.
Well, you'd be the one who would be doing it. So.
Right, right. But you have to sort of, you work out the deal. You cut the deal with them and figure out what it is that they want. And then you fill the plant with people that are actually working and then are paying taxes into the system. The other thing that we need to do is, which we don't do as well as Pennsylvania, Delaware, Virginia, is we need to retain our companies but also attract new companies and talk to them about what it is they need, because we're 46th in adult training, for example, workforce development, and we can do a better job of helping them with workforce development and some of the other issues.
One of the things that you've proposed, and this is where you differ from your two rivals for the nomination, is a plan to cut corporate income taxes, the goal of moving them from their current 8.25% to 6%, is that right? Over the course of several years, 6% is the same corporate income tax rate that Virginia has. Explain your proposal, and you know that the proposal has faced multiple criticisms, so address those.
Well, it's only been criticized by the lieutenant governor because he has no record. He's never really managed anybody or run.
Well, it's been criticized by many people other than the lieutenant governor who are not actually running.
Yeah, but based on lieutenant governor's prodding, because it clearly makes complete sense. I mean, what we've talked about is closing the multinational corporate loophole, combined reporting, so that we'll be able to bring in $200 million a year of companies like McDonald's that are operating in our state but not paying taxes because of that loophole. So we'll close that loophole and bring in an enormous amount of money. But at the same time, we'll reduce the corporate taxes, you mentioned, from 8.25% to 6%, by a quarter of a point a year. And companies will continue to come in, and that'll bring hundreds of millions of dollars into Maryland, as opposed to actually losing money. So that's something we're looking
forward to doing. So you would pay for the reduction in the corporate tax rate by bringing in new companies, so more tax revenue coming in from multiple companies, and also combined reporting.
Well, combined reporting is the one piece of it. But yes, we pay for it, as you say. The reduction, I mean, it might not happen the first week that more companies come, but clearly as you become more competitive with your neighbors, more companies will come, more jobs will come, the tax base will grow. And the problem we have here in Maryland is we come to Annapolis every year with a quarter, either half a billion to $1 billion deficit every year because we're losing so many jobs. We have 76% more people unemployed than when Brown took over. We've lost over 8,000 small businesses in the last 8 years. So what's going on here? You can't imagine what would be happen if we had another 8 years of saying, let's build our economy on the top of more taxes and more casino gambling instead of actually bringing jobs to Maryland. And all we're trying to do is make us competitive with our neighbors on the corporate tax. If you're the guy who owns a company, you're coming from Indianapolis, and Virginia says, look, the tax rate's 6%, right across the river is 8.25%, you're going to pick 6% every time. And 6% of something is a lot more than 8.25% of nothing.
Now, I think somewhere you said that if you could only address one measure of tax policy, it would be combined reporting. Is that correct?
No.
No?
Because I've been very reluctant to say, like, the people say, well, let's get rid of the gas tax or get rid of the rain tax or all these other taxes that they've put in, that most of which are regressive. What I'm trying to do is say, look, let's look at our whole tax policy in a competitive nature, figure out where we need, what taxes no longer make sense so that we can become competitive with our neighboring states, because that's who's cleaning our clock. Virginia, in particular, is cleaning our clock. They're growing while we're starving over here and squeezing the middle class. And the middle class is who loses on this deal. The middle class is who's getting squeezed out of Maryland right now. There was a recent poll by Gallup that said 47% of the people in Maryland would rather live somewhere else. Now, that may be fine with my competitors who didn't grow up in Maryland. This is my state. I love this state, and I can't believe that in Maryland there's 47% of the people want to go somewhere else because of the taxes.
I have to nitpick with you on that, Gans,
okay.
The Gallup thing, because about half of the people who said they would want to leave Maryland had nothing to do with any policy. It had to do with weather or family or some job that they wanted somewhere else, nothing that you could actually change.
Well, governor. I couldn't change the weather, but I do think that
Or where their family's living. That'd be very difficult to do.
Well, maybe. I mean, look, that's not my understanding of the poll, and otherwise, the weather's always been the same, and there's been families all
exactly.
over the country, so there's nothing different different except for what the tax policy and the jobs policy that these people have put in.
Yeah, but tax policy, I believe, that of the people that said they were going to leave because if it was something like 8% of those who wanted to leave was because of taxes. Just because you're citing the poll, I feel the need to get into
Well, I mean, look, there's a reason why almost half the people want to leave Maryland. You can decide whatever you want it to be.
I can't decide what I want it to be. They asked them. Right. The Gallup poll asked them. So if you're citing the poll, their responses are actually part of that.
Be that as it may, I can tell you what I hear. The people that I hear don't want to. They think the tax burden is overwhelming here, and 40 straight taxes is not the way to balance.
Well, and they do say that. That poll also showed that, but that wasn't the reason that most of them wanted to leave. But yes, they did say that. Okay, one more thing before we leave combined reporting, because I do think it's important, because that is something that has been pushed in the legislature for many years now, only with varying success. It's never gone very far. Earlier this year, the Maryland Chamber of Commerce said its number one legislative priority was to prevent combined reporting from going anywhere. If that is an important part of your tax policy, and it's been used in, I think 20 other states already have combined reporting.
Right.
In fact, it's not as if it's something that's new or novel.
I think it's 24, but
is it 24?
Yeah. But over 20 states have.
How do you get that through the legislature, given such powerful opposition from business groups? Especially,
I think one of the things that people now recognize in Maryland as they go to the polls on Tuesday is there's a very stark contrast between the lieutenant governor and myself. He is literally bought by the special interest. If you look at the millions and millions of dollars of negative ads and other ads and his report, it's completely special interest money and powerful interest groups. I've run and won 4 elections in the state of Maryland. I've never been beholden to the special interests. I'm beholden to the people of Maryland. And so when I get to Annapolis, I won't have those problems about that powerful interest group because they weren't behind me. They have a very strong interest in maintaining the last 8 years and having the status quo perpetuate itself. We're unencumbered by that. We can actually get there and fix the schools. That we have the second worst minority achievement gap in the country. We're failing our children. I'm not beholden to anybody. We could actually go in and fix those schools, make sure there's quality teachers in every classroom, that we actually have pre-K expanded from half day to full day, which I was the first person to talk about and looking to expand. And all these other issues that are out there are not going to be driven by the special interest. They're going to be driven by what's in the best interest of the state of Maryland, as I've shown that I can and will do for the last 22 years in public service.
And I want to talk about pre-K education, but we'll do that a little bit later this hour. Because you actually brought up negative ads being brought by the Brown campaign, one of your chief rivals, I'm going to go to the phone now because Brown is not the only candidate running for the Democratic nomination who has aired negative ads. Olivia from Bethesda, you're on the air. Welcome to Midday. What's your question for Doug Gansler?
So I have been following this election pretty closely, and I have seen a lot of negativity, and a lot of that negativity does seem to come from you, Mr. Gansler, and I'm just wondering, will you support the Democratic nominee in the general election?
Yeah, I don't think most of the negativities actually come from the lieutenant governor. It started last summer. They actually got the state police involved and had these fabricated stories, and they've been really lodging negative ads on television and through the mail ever since. We were just talking about two of them, as a matter of fact. I'm sure if you live in Bethesda and you're a Democrat, you probably got all 5 mailers that they sent out saying that I wanted to have a 1.6 corporate tax giveaway to, you know, big businesses, and that I was against children and hated children or whatever. I didn't want to expand pre-K when, in fact, I was the first candidate running for governor to say we should expand pre-K from half day to full day for all Marylanders, though we should start in the underserved areas to actually address the minority achievement gap issue. And clearly, by reducing the corporate tax by 0.25% a year, you're actually bringing money into the state, bringing jobs into the state. So, you know, but that's the kind of negative ads that we've seen and hopefully will not be perpetuated. I'm a Democrat. I've been a Democrat all my life. I've been in Maryland practically all my life. And so, you know, I'm excited about winning this nomination on Tuesday, and hopefully the lieutenant governor and the delegate will support us.
Well, we have to take a short break here as we conclude Candidates Week on Midday with Democrat Doug Gansler. When we get back, more with the outgoing Attorney General. And, of course, we want to hear from you. Your calls, 410-662-8780. Your emails, midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. Music. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in today for Dan Rodericks, and we are in our final interview here on Midday's Candidates Week. On the Democratic side, we've heard from Delegate Heather Mazier and Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown earlier this week. Today, we're joined by Attorney General Doug Gansler, the final candidate to seeking the Democratic nomination to speak to you here on Midday before Tuesday's primary election. Doug Gansler, again, thank you for joining us this hour.
It's great to be here.
One of your opponents, Lieutenant Governor Brown, says he thinks that you should have been more attentive as Attorney General to the rollout of Maryland's health insurance exchange. Obviously, the health insurance exchange rollout was completely botched when it happened last fall. A lot of things have gone on since then. Tell us your view.
Well, I'm actually the Attorney General, so I had no role on that other than running President Obama's campaign here in Maryland when the Lieutenant Governor did not support him, and then going to the Supreme Court of the United States and making sure that the Affordable Care Act was upheld with its constitutionality, actually being the lead state in front of the Supreme Court on that, because I do believe that it was wrong that America was the only country in the civilized world that did not understand that health care was a right and should be provided to all its citizens. The interesting thing about the Affordable Care rollout is that this is literally the only thing that Lieutenant Governor's ever managed or ever been put in charge of, ever run.
And, well, Brack.
And that was also an unmitigated disaster in terms of the support for Brack, though he's kind of run away from that lately. But he tried to run away from this as well. And the tragedy of the Affordable Care Act rollout is a number of things. One, and the most important, is there's literally hundreds of thousands of Marylanders that still don't have access to health care because of the national embarrassment that was our rollout under the Lieutenant Governor. So children that need chemotherapy and people that need, you know, diabetes testing and so forth can't get it. There's also $200 million flushed down the drain in terms of this website that, of course, he won't be transparent on. He won't come to the hearings. And how are we supposed to fix it if we can't find out what went wrong in the first place? And now they went and they did the same thing. They went into a closed room with no transparency, no competition, and said, well, let's pick the Connecticut system, when even the people in Connecticut have said that it's not going to work by the November 15th reopening of the exchange. What I said is, look, let's go to the federal website. That works. It didn't work right at the beginning. President Obama got in there. He rolled up his sleeves. Fixed it. 50,000 people were getting enrolled a day. So it's free and it's available tomorrow. Why wouldn't we go through the federal system into the Maryland Exchange? And so I think that is actually a big difference between the two of us. I'm somebody who's actually been getting things done for 22 years. The biggest example I use is when I was elected by my peers to be the president of the National Association of Attorneys General, we reached a settlement with the big banks, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and so forth. And to this moment, we've gotten $1.5 billion into the state of Maryland for foreclosure relief, for principal reduction, loan modification, and has kept tens of thousands of real families in their homes that would otherwise been foreclosed upon. I think the contrast in leadership is quite stark.
The money that we spent on the first website, how much was that again?
It's about 160-some-odd million. Then they put another 40 to 50 into the Connecticut retrofit.
So you're opposed to, of course, putting more money after the system. You said you want to go to the federal healthcare website.
I mean, ultimately, they should get a Maryland system.
I mean, what's going to happen next? I mean, now the new money has already been sent towards the Connecticut version.
Right.
So are you, if you're elected governor, will you push forward there?
Well, I think that once the money's been spent and we have the Connecticut system, we can need to continue to work on the Maryland Exchange. And the Maryland Exchange will now be run by Deloitte, which is the company that was doing the Connecticut system, and we'll continue to work on that because ultimately, you know, 5 years down the road or whatever the year might be, we're going to have our own independent Maryland Exchange. But in the meantime, I would let people sign up either through the federal site or the Maryland site. Of course, the Maryland site's only signed up, you know, dozens of people, as far as we can tell, unless the Maryland site's fixed. And when I'm governor, obviously, we'll get it fixed because that's what I do. And so we'll ultimately go toward the Maryland system. In the meantime, let people sign up on either one of them.
You criticized your rival, Anthony Brown, for the role he played in the rollout of Obamacare here in Maryland. Brown says that you sat on the same health care reform coordinating council that he did and didn't show up for meetings. Do you bear some responsibility there?
I bear absolutely no responsibility whatsoever for the Affordable Care Act rollout website, which I had nothing to do with. And what he is talking about is a committee, one of the many committees that he actually was the chair of. Either I was there or my deputy was there at every single meeting of that committee, which had nothing to do with the website. It was actually what would be included once somebody got enrolled in the Merrill Exchange. For example, one of the areas I've been very focused on is that the insurance companies should pay for behavioral therapy for autistic children. You know, under the Affordable Care Act, there's a lot of flexibility to individual states to put things in, and that's one of the things I wanted to put in. But it's easy to point fingers. Look, I didn't ask him to be the head of the Affordable Care Act rollout. He was out there, you know, talking about it for 3 years. The Washington Post did an expose, said he knew it wasn't going to work for a year ahead of time and still didn't tell anybody.
But Brown said he wasn't on the committee that was involved with the website either.
Well, I'm glad that you understood what he said, because I was at that debate and I was like, what was that? You know, here's somebody that says, I'm in charge of the Affordable Care Act rollout in Maryland. All the other entrenched politicians that have supported him said, don't worry, Anthony Brown's in charge, it'll get taken care of. And then it was an unmitigated disaster. He started saying, well, I was on this committee and then we did the workarounds and we did the plus and this and that. I'm like, what are you talking about? Just look, you made a mistake. You didn't do what you're supposed to do. Instead, you raised almost $1 million from healthcare companies instead. Instead of actually managing the Affordable Care Act rollout, you were out there raising money from lobbyists, and you have a healthcare lobbyist on your staff, and you raised almost $1 million from healthcare companies that you were supposed to actually be regulating instead of bringing money in from them. And just say, look, I did something wrong, and move on. But he didn't do that.
Brown has characterized you as, quote, cheering like a Republican for the failings of Obamacare in Maryland. How do you respond to that?
Well, obviously, it's silly. It's nothing to do with one of the problems with his debacle of running the Affordable Care Act is it gives the Republicans an opportunity to go after the Affordable Care Act. The problem is this has nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act. This is just the website to get into the Affordable Care Act. So that, you know, that's when he has nothing to say, of course, he's going to say I'm a Republican, when in fact I was the one that supported President Obama. He wasn't. I was the one that went to the Supreme Court to make sure it was upheld constitutionally. With constitutionality, he wasn't. He was supposed to be running this thing. He didn't. And in the aftermath, he's been part of the cover-up. Because, you know, look, if you're going to fix the exchange ultimately in November, you have to know what they did wrong. It's kind of like their Baltimore jail scandal. I called for an independent investigation into that. What happened? Let's find out. And of course, they said, no, we got this. And look what's happened on it. Nothing.
The two of you, Lieutenant Governor Brown and you yourself, have been a bit vocally opposing each other for multiple things. We have a call for clarification from one of our listeners who said that you never answered the question whether you would endorse the nominee for governor if that was not you. Would you endorse one of the other Democratic candidates should you not win the nomination?
Sure, but we're going to win the nomination because I think the people of Maryland don't believe in coronations. They don't believe in the special interest controlling Annapolis anymore. They don't want the machine to pick the next governor. The people will. And the people are going to pick somebody who's been doing in public service for 22, 23 years, getting things done. And the middle class is sick of getting squeezed by taxes. So I think they're going to come. People are coming our way. We're getting votes. And I think we'll be fine on Tuesday.
I'm going to move on to environmental issues now briefly. We have a question from Bradley via email saying the Earth is warming and is driven mainly by carbon emissions from human activity. Do you agree with that assessment? And if so, where can Maryland work to be in the lead in reducing carbon pollution?
Yeah, not only should Maryland work to be in the lead, Maryland should be in the lead in terms of climate change and carbon production. I mean, I've been fighting this for the last 8 years as the Attorney General. But my number one priority has been the environment, cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay, going after polluters. You know, my opponent is being funded by the pollution lobby, so clearly nothing will change there.
The pollution lobby?
Yeah, all the Purdue's and the people that are actually doing the polluting are in the utility companies and Exelon, and they're all putting tons of money into his campaign because they want to continue to pollute, and we don't.
What would you do differently?
Well, I would continue what I've been doing. See, the difference between me and my opponent is I've actually done things. I actually have a record. So as Attorney General, I was the head of the National Association of Attorneys General on the environmental side. We had the biggest environmental settlement in the history of the United States involving 14 coal-burning power plants in the Ohio River Valley called American Electric Power.
Cross-state air pollution.
Yeah, which is $4.6 billion. And I just actually took $1 million and put it into level 3 electric car stations throughout Maryland. Maryland. We've had the biggest water pollution settlement in the history of Maryland, air pollution settlement. You know, I've been doing this for 8 years, not election time, but every 3 months starting 8 years ago, we've been doing river audits all around the state, looking at issues that are ubiquitous and issues that are peculiar to that particular river shed, and then bringing enforcement actions and more. And so I've been pushing, for example, and I got legislation passed to convert chick manure into energy to be a tier one source. So we can take half a billion pounds of the 1.3, 1.4 billion pounds of chicken manure produced every year and make it into 55 megawatts of power. That's the kind of thing that we're going to do when I'm governor.
If you become the nominee, you will be going up against a Republican gubernatorial candidate who is opposed to the stormwater remediation fees, the so-called rain tax that were put into law a couple years ago and are beginning to go into effect now, fees that are being charged to people in Maryland's 10 largest jurisdictions. Do you feel the current system needs to be tweaked? Are you in favor of the fees as they are now?
Well, we actually wrote the stormwater management plans, and we've been enforcing stormwater runoff for years, prosecuting people that are shortcutting the laws. Do I think the law as it's put in is perfect right now? No. Can it be expanded? Yes. Can it be more justly applied? Yes.
How would you do so?
Well, I think you have to look at the other counties and why are 10 counties being sort of taxed here, if you proverbial and literally, and others aren't. And I think, but my whole thing, as I mentioned earlier, is not to sort of pick on one of the 40 taxes that they've raised, but to look at all of them in terms of from the jobs perspective and the individual perspective, and figure out how can we be competitive with our neighboring states? How can we protect our seniors that are being overtaxed? How can we make it so that people can actually retire in Maryland and can stay with their families and don't feel like they have to leave to go to Pennsylvania or Delaware or Virginia? And so we really have to sort of look at the entire competitiveness of our tax structure.
Of the taxes and fees that have been raised over the last 8 years, which ones are you in favor of? Which ones are you strongly supporting?
Well, you're going to keep at this back and forth. I'm going to tell you, I'm just not going to. I mean, look, it doesn't make sense. They've raised 40 straight taxes. They put another 30 some odd fees on top of that. And what we need to do is be competitive and make sure we look at all of them. And so, because what happens is if you pick one of them, like Brown, the lieutenant governor's made a big deal on my corporate tax, that I actually want to bring companies back to Maryland so that there's jobs in Maryland, so people actually have work. And, you know, it's sad to see Bethlehem Steel go down. You know, 30,000 people used to work there, and the people that used to work there can't find jobs now because we don't retrain them. And so, you know, you can sort of look at this tax or that tax, and people focus on that. But the fact of the matter is we need to bring jobs back to Maryland. We're bleeding jobs. There's no way, shape, or form you can say that we're doing great economically, even though he does. And that's how we can fix our state.
One last environmental issue. People in favor of hydraulic fracturing to extract natural gas from the land underneath Western Maryland say that would certainly bring jobs to the state. Are you in favor of hydraulic fracturing to bring natural gas to the top? And on that topic, what are your thoughts on the Cove Point the gas export facility that's proposed for Southern Maryland?
Yeah, so I have what I think is a practical, realistic response in terms of hydraulic fracturing, which is the way I deal with most of these issues, which is to say, look, right now we should not have fracking in Maryland. It has not been proven to be safe. As a matter of fact, I went after a company called Chesapeake Power, which blew up two wells in Pennsylvania and potentially contaminated the water there and here. And we went after them and got a large fine and also made sure we had monitoring on that. But there may be a day when it is completely safe. We shouldn't bring fracking to Maryland for jobs. That's not what, you know, you shouldn't contaminate the drinking water to bring jobs. But if and when there is a day when it's safe, then yes. Because it's cheap, it's free, it's here. We'd rather not be dependent on coal-burning power, which hurts us with climate change, and we have 14 of the worst jurisdictions for air quality here in Maryland. And we shouldn't be sending kids off to war for oil. But for right now, unless and until it is proven to be clean and safe, I think we should continue with what we're doing right now and have a moratorium on it.
What would have to happen for it to be proven to be clean and safe?
Well, the science would have to be such that, I mean, for example, in the Midwest where they have vertical fracking, it's basically safe. I mean, the wells don't blow up, the water's completely clean and all that. The difference is what we're doing in the Marcellus Shale is that it's vertical. So it's horizontal. So the pipe goes down and then cuts across, and that's where the potential leakage is. There, you know, the technology is continuing to advance, and there may be a time when it is safe, so the science shows that the water's not being contaminated.
But to your mind, that time is not now.
In my mind, that time is clearly not now. And you know, that's why I went after the companies that blew up the wells.
One of the issues that your campaign highlights on its website as being an important issue to you is good government. Those are your priorities. You've talked about increasing integrity in Maryland government. Specifically, what do you want to do on that front?
Well, we've identified $1.5 billion in savings, for example. Which, for example, the procurement process was $8 billion of government contracts given out, which are lack competition, lack transparency. And that's why you get, for example, when they do the Affordable Care Act, why the lieutenant governor picked a company from Fargo, North Dakota, literally, to be the technology company for that. And so we need to shed some light on, and have some transparency in our government. There's, you know, one of the problems with having a one-party system is that there ends up being people that have a little excessive control and aren't necessarily focused on transparency and competition. I think we need to have a lot more of that, including when you just said about the website, including more technology, you know, having things more accessible to people over the internet.
You just mentioned the potential problems of being a one-party system, and Maryland is, of course, an extremely heavily Democratic state. 2-to-1 voter advantage, I think, is what they what they say. But while we're a 2-to-1 voter advantage in Maryland, our representation in Congress is 7-to-1, and this is in part because Maryland is widely considered to have some of the most gerrymandered political districts in the entire country. If you become governor, there is the possibility that there could be some reform to the current redistricting process, even though that would, by necessity, diminish a little bit your party's power, possibly, in Washington, D.C. Would you be in favor of redistricting reform? I mean, the closer we get to the next redistricting time, the more difficult it's going to be to do it. So it's this term, probably, this governor, if it's going to happen, would have to be looking at that.
Yeah, I am in favor of redistricting reform. I think, I put together a campaign finance reform bipartisan committee of 27 recommendations, of which 13 or 14 have already been adopted. I think there's too much power in this for the special interests in Annapolis, and they control the redistricting. So I don't think that people in Garrett County should have the same congressperson as Potomac, Maryland. I just don't see that there's a lot of overlap in interests there other than the fact that they're human beings. The other thing I want to see actually happen as we go toward Tuesday is I think we ought to look at the idea of independents being able to vote in a primary. So, you shouldn't have to compromise your ideology. If you want to remain an independent, you should be able to pick either Republican or Democratic primary to vote in on Election Day and enfranchise more people.
Republicans have opened it up once in the past. They've considered it every so often again. I don't believe the Democrats have even considered opening up their primary process.
Well, I think some have. And you know, to me, you're going to get more Democrats in the party. And, you know, the problem with the Democratic Party in Maryland right now is the candidates. And we have to make sure we always have good candidates. We have a lot of great people running for office. But what happens is when they get to Annapolis, then the special interests control Democrats or Republicans. It's just the culture in Annapolis needs to change. But one of the things I think would help that would be if independents were able to pick either Republican or Democratic side at the primary, then the special interests would have less of a stranglehold on the politicians.
Quick question from the phones before we go to a break. Matthew in Baltimore, you're on the air with Attorney General Doug Gansler.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Mr. Gansler, I had a question for you. Of the Democratic candidates, you're the one I'm most interested in, honestly. And I've seen Second Amendment issues lately be a divisive issue for obvious reasons, based on the recent laws. And I was curious, as an independent who's pro-Second Amendment, what you'll do rather than to drive people like me away, what you'll do to try to attract my vote and give me some surety of my protections in your campaign.
Well,
and I'll take my question off the air.
Thank you. You know, your question actually has a lot of the answers in it, which is you said something about the Second Amendment being divisive. And that, you know, it's really has been polarizing. I don't understand why that is. You know, I think most people are comfortable with the notion that if you want to have a gun in your house to protect yourself from some knucklehead that wants to come in and harm your family, that you ought to be able to do that as long as it's kept safely. And if you're a hunter, or you ought to be able to have your hunting rifles. At the same time, most people don't think you should be able to walk down the middle of Pratt Street loaded up with AK-47s. And so there's a lot of middle ground there. And so, you know, right now the state of the case, you know, I've been a prosecutor now for 22 years. And so the state of the Second Amendment is that you have the right to have a handgun in your home to be used for self-defense. My goal is to make sure we keep guns away from people with three different types of issues. One is mental health problems. One is somebody who's domestic violence issues, and I've been, you know, I started the first domestic violence dockets, and I've been very, and I led the charge to make sure that we got guns out of people that have protective orders against them for domestic violence cases. And the third is convicted felons. So I think we ought to look at what they do on the federal side, which is if a felon has a gun and is toting a gun around the streets, which is the large amount of the murders in Baltimore City, because we have one of the most violent cities in the country here, that those people should get mandatory time in jail like they do on the federal side. And other, you know, people that protect their guns at home and so forth, they should be able to do so.
That's Doug Gansler, running to be Maryland's next governor. The primary election for the Democratic and Republican parties is Tuesday of next week. Have to take another quick break. When we get back, more with candidate Gansler and with Gansler's running mate, Delegate Julian Ivey. Of course, your questions are welcome. Midday at WYPR.org, by phone, 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. You are tuned to Midday with Dan Rodericks, although it's without Dan Rodericks today. I'm Nathan Sterner sitting in for him this afternoon. And we're closing out Midday's Candidates Week this hour with Doug Gansler, Democratic candidate for governor. We are also now joined by Gansler's running mate, Delegate Julian Ivey, who represents Maryland's 47th district located in Prince George's County. A D.C. native, Towson University grad, elected to the state legislature in 2006, serves on the Legislative Black Caucus of Maryland, and she is here in studio now to tell us about her experience in government and the Gansler-Ivey ticket. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
So why do you think that you should be Maryland's Lexi Clevin governor, and why do you want to be lieutenant governor alongside Doug Gansler?
Doug Gansler is the reason I'm here. I wouldn't be here if not for him. If anyone else had asked me who's running, I would have said no, because Doug and I have so much in common. Our views for what we want to have happen here in the state are very, very similar. We're not in lockstep, but we have the same vision. We have the same passions. When it comes to education, for example, every time I hear the lieutenant governor talk about we're number one in education, my teeth are set on edge, because my children go to Prince George's County Public Schools, and I hate to give you the bad news, but we're not number one in education. No, we're number two in the achievement gap, and that's the problem. I don't like that the children who go to school in my jurisdiction aren't getting the same education as the children in Bethesda, for example. And until you have someone who recognizes there's a problem, you're never going to find a solution. And Doug Gansler recognizes there's a problem, and he's a fighter to get something done. So I appreciate Doug for that, and that's why I'm happy to be his partner.
Well, let's pick up on the issue of education while we're there, Doug and Jolene. What changes would you make to our current education system if elected?
The most important thing, as I view it, is starting with the very youngest children. And I know we've had a big fight politically and in the media about who cares more about pre-K, but honest to God, that's not where the problem starts. And Doug recognizes that. We want to have a program that we call Maryland Matters that deals with teen moms who are at risk and starts from the time they're pregnant and works with them until the children start pre-K. So it's in those formative years that these moms need help, they need mentoring, and the moms who have this kind of mentoring, their children enter school with an 8 to 10,000 word vocabulary instead of a 3,000 word vocabulary. The difference isn't pre-K. Pre-K is great, and we want to have pre-K. It's very valuable, and I'm not going to minimize it. But the real problems we have in our schools start at home long before these children get to pre-K, and we have a plan to do something about it.
So it's really pre-K plus.
Right.
Well, it's pre-K. You know, Jolene is actually, she started a national nonprofit called Mocha Moms, which has over 100 chapters around the country, and it's about women of color and surrounding parenting issues. And so she's very passionate about that particular portion of a child's life from zero, basically, until pre-K. We are the first candidate to talk about expanded pre-K from half day to full day, which is what they were supposed to do with the money from casino gambling when it went from slots to tables, and they took it off. But we want to put that back. We just want to start with the areas that need it most. It shouldn't be that we live in a state where it matters what color you are, what your zip code is, whether or not you get access to a good education. And so we want to expand for the people that are 300% above the poverty line and below for pre-K, and then ultimately for everybody. I've already talked about at the back end with the vocational and career apprenticeship programs for people to that don't want to continue the traditional path. The other issue, though, is what's in between. What happens to K through 12? And in our view, because we're not encumbered by the special interests, we can actually have serious and real reform. And not only and to make sure that not only do we have new schools and new construction that are built in Baltimore City, Baltimore County, Prince George's County, Montgomery County, and elsewhere, but that inside those classrooms that every child has access to a skilled teacher, a quality, good teacher. And because we have so many wonderful teachers here, we should pay them more. The nationally board certified teachers should be getting a lot more money, but the ineffective teachers that have been sitting there, and you could go to any school and say, ask any kid, any teacher, who are the good teachers, who are the bad teachers? And you're always going to get the same answer about particularly who the bad teachers are. And there should be a peer assessment review system put into place where the bad teachers are weeded out, as they do in, say, Montgomery County, where working with the unions have taken hundreds of teachers that are ineffective and put them elsewhere, and then have hired really good quality teachers that are really going to teach your children not only how to pass the test, but how to want to learn.
This sort of skill over seniority thing for teachers that you're talking about, would this require a mass change to teacher contracts around the state? How would you put that into place?
Well, I think you'd work with the unions as they did in Montgomery County, you know, and try to figure out how are we going to make sure that we can see right now what happens is you're 22 years old, you come out of college, and at 25, you're tenured as a teacher, which doesn't really happen in a lot of other professions. And so you have to continue to have the incentive for those teachers to want to learn and want to continue to become better teachers as in every other profession. And that you can do that in a number of ways. One is paying them more, paying the quality good teachers more. And then the issue always is, I mean, people will say, well, I'm not for bad teachers. But how do you determine that? And I think the best way to do that is this peer assessment review system where the teachers themselves are doing it, not teaching the test, because you want to create incentives for teachers to go into underserved areas, children with learning disabilities and that kind of thing. But you want to have teachers that are really touching the kids, getting into the kids' minds that they want to go home and read another book, that they want to, it's sort of the old proverb about giving somebody a fish or teaching them how to fish. We want the teachers that are going to teach these children how to fish.
Back to pre-K programs. The planned expansion of our current pre-K system is one that you've planned on funding with casino revenues. The program that you, Delegate Ivy, spoke about for mothers to pre-K, how would that be funded? Casinos or something else?
No, the biggest part of that program would be done with volunteers, by partnering with the faith community, other community volunteers, and also possibly with student teachers. So it wouldn't be a huge extra cost to the state, but it would be an enormous benefit to the state.
How would that be managed?
We'd have someone at the top to make sure that everyone is trained and that people pass a background check. I think that's a really important part.
I think the more important question is how do you afford not to do it? And, you know, we've identified $1.5 billion in savings from the current system. But most importantly, when you're in Baltimore City, for example, and you have 94% of the children in ninth grade that aren't going to graduate from college, and you have 80% of the students that do graduate need remedial math and 70% need remedial English, that's unsustainable economically. So if you put the money in up front, you're not going to be paying as much in the back.
As Attorney General, you've been the state's top lawyer. We have a question from John D. in Prince George's County that has to do with the legal system to some degree. John, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
How are you? Yes, my name is John Davis, and they call me John D. I'm in Prince George's County, and I've been in corrections over in parole probation over 40 years. I got one question for Mr. Dantzler King. Over 630,000 inmates are released from prison, state and local jails yearly. After 3 years, 50% recidivate. If you have a reentry plan, what will be your strategy and what would it look like?
Well, so this is, thank you for the question. This is an issue that has never really been in a governor's race as far as I can tell anywhere in the country. And I started bringing this up back last summer. We actually met at a restaurant called Darker Than Blue right in Baltimore City and had experts on this subject because in Maryland, we spend $1.3 billion on our criminal system. We have over 23,000 people in jail and 144,000 in our system, most of whom are coming out. And because we have, as you said, 50, it's actually in Maryland, it's 46% recidivism rate, means they're going back into jail within 3 years. And by the way, these aren't just numbers. These are real people. These are children of somebody, parents of somebody. They come from the community. 59% of them are coming back into Baltimore City, however. And other states, Virginia, Michigan, Oregon, have actually dealt with this issue of recidivism and gotten the numbers down instead of to 50% or 46% into the 20s. Michigan was able to close 20 correctional facilities by taking people who are behind bars and making them tax-paying citizens. So, you know, we've identified a number of ways to do that, things that other states have done. But one of them, for example, is to educate people in while they're in prison. We pay $33,000 a year to house somebody. You work with them. You get them the ability to go online and get trained, get a certification while they're in prison. Say they want to be an auto mechanic or a cook when they come out, so that when they come out, they take the online class. They come out, they're now certified to be a cook or an auto mechanic, and then you give companies that are willing to hire people that might have made a mistake in their past, a tax incentive to hire those folks, and now they have a job. Because when you come out, you need a job, a place to live, and somebody who cares. But a job's pretty important.
You come from Montgomery County, but you have said that you are the Baltimore City candidate. You're wearing an Orioles tie,
yeah.
Because, of course, your office is here in Baltimore City. I have a question about public transportation. There are two major public transit projects, as you know, competing for federal dollars, the proposed Purple Line in the D.C. suburbs, the proposed Red Line here in Baltimore. Which one are you more in favor of, or will you push equally to ensure that both of your homes are served by these systems?
Yeah, and Jolene, who's sitting here, went to Towson, and she worked here in Baltimore, and her husband, Glenn Ivey, who is the state's attorney in Prince George, has also worked up here. And I think this is one of the biggest differences in this election, frankly, not just the transportation, but it's rhetoric in some sense, we're the candidates from Baltimore, but I can tell you, if we are not elected, Baltimore will suffer the next 8 years because the other people running against couldn't find Pratt Street with a map. They don't know the difference between Reservoir Hill and Druid Hill and Shipley Hill. And they're not, you know, when we announced that we were running, we were in the neighborhoods because Baltimore needs, the neighborhoods need a governor. And so that's pretty important. In terms of the mass transit, yes, critical. You know, we're now in the most congested area in the country that's happened over the last 8 years. And here we are. And this is where we find ourselves. So yes, we need to look at the Purple Line, the Red Line. In addition to those two projects, which are now sort of well on their way, and both need, by the way, some revision, our big project is high-speed rail from Baltimore to Washington. You know, we talk all the time about repopulating Baltimore, a city that used to be vibrant and had almost 1 million people, now is almost 300 people getting killed a year and only 630,000 people in the city. If you had high-speed rail going from Baltimore and D.C. and back, you can get downtown 12, 15, 18 minutes, people would come back in the city. It would be cool again. It'd be like Philadelphia.
The city's still cool, I'm going to say, as a city
resident.
Cool.
It's so cool. So, but it's a city that's needs just a little watering, and if it's not like Philadelphia and D.C. down the street, and we can do that, but there's a number of mass transit projects would be part of that as well.
We've got to wrap quick, but quick question to you, Delegate Ivey. The office of Lieutenant Governor is a relatively ill-defined one. What would you try to accomplish as Lieutenant Governor, and Doug Ensler, what would you want Delegate Ivey to do as your Lieutenant Governor?
Well, one thing would be education, and that's something we've already talked a lot about. I have 5 children. They've mostly been in the public schools, and I'm the House Chair of Children, Youth, and Families right now, and I'm on the Education Subcommittee. So I have a lot of experience in education. I'm a parent who's been extremely involved in the public schools. When I was home for 16 years with my kids, I spent a lot of time volunteering in the classroom, so I have a lot of a diverse experience dealing with schools. So that's one thing I'm going to focus a lot about. Schools education. And another thing that Doug and I have talked about is transportation being a big issue. So I think it's important that we give a lot of focus. When you travel around the state, the whole state needs transit.
It's final thought. You know, Jolene's also the chair of the Prince George's County delegation, so we'll need somebody like Jolene who gets along with everybody, has the passion and authenticity to get in there and make sure our broad plan of going against the special interest is actually passed.
Delegate Jolene Ivey, Attorney General Doug Gansler, thank you so much
thank
for
you,
joining
Nathan.
Us. The
thank
primary
you.
Election is Tuesday of next week. Be sure to head to the polls if you didn't already get it done during early voting. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Dan Rodericks. Thank you so much.
Midday Senior Producer is Nikki Gamer. The Producer and Director is Jonathan Ahrens. The Associate Producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, and Anna Muckerman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Rodrick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.